Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and this Friday is the 30th anniversary of the so-called Central Park jogger attack, a very dark day in the history of New York City, both for the brutal rape and beating of the victim around the 102nd Street transverse in the park, and then of the wrongful convictions of five Black and Latino teenagers for the attack, which a confession and DNA evidence later show to have been committed by someone else. So much went wrong in the justice system that allowed that injustice to happen. For the record, the rape victim's name, long known, is Trisha Mailey. The wrongly convicted teens, now in their 40s, names are Raymond Santana, Kevin Richardson, Antron McRae, Yusef Salam, and Carrie Wise, just to humanize everybody involved by saying their names out loud. The guy who apparently really did it is Matias Reyes, who, when he confessed and his DNA was consistent with the semen at the scene, had committed multiple rapes in the same area before and after the one on April 19th, 1989. So we'll talk about the Central Park jogger attack 30 years later and the lessons to be learned now with WNYC's Jamie Floyd, our All Things Considered host and legal analyst, and Jim Dwyer, New York Times writer and author of the book, an interactive book from 2014 called False Conviction, Innocence, Guilt, and Science. Jim was writing for Newsday at the time and has expressed regrets about how much of the media covered the story. Hi, Jamie. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi, Brian.
Jim, there was a lot of crime in New York in 1989. Mayor Ed Koch's last year in office, including 1,900 murders, which was a record high. Why did this one assault become the media obsession that it did?
It became a big proxy for all of the disorder in New York. And, you know, it was also a matter of race and class. Patricia Mailey was an investment banker, and she was believed to have been assaulted by a group of Latino and Black teenagers. And it just was like a centrifuge at the time, where everybody got pinned into the positions of their original views on the case and never moved off of it.
But why? I mean, like I say, there was so much crime in New York. Why this one?
Well, it seemed at first to have been a gang rape and essentially a near murder by a group of kids who were described to have stood at the around watching this woman being brutalized. And it was this nightmare scene that was presented as the events of the day. And it was horrifying. It took your breath away to think that young people could do such terrible things.
And if I may, Brian, it also fit a narrative that goes back to Jim Crow and before, of the Black man and the white woman, Emmett Till, and before that. I mean, if we think about what might have happened if this were, say, 1900, or 1920, or even 1950. I mean, if you go down to Bryan Stevenson's memorial and see how painfully and accurately he's captured the history of lynching, when we talk about the white woman as victim in this society, both in law and in the way we cover these kinds of cases, when a white woman is victimized and it is perceived that a Black man is the perpetrator, the stakes become so much more clear and higher for those of us who tell the story to get it right.
And, class,
and as we know, we got it so very wrong in this case.
And class implications, too. Lower income kids and this woman who worked on Wall Street, who I guess part of the narrative was, even if you have that much money, because you are, I don't know exactly what she made, but a supposedly comfortable person who lives in a fairly well-to-do neighborhood of New York City and works on Wall Street and has that income, is not safe.
That was a part of it. I mean, I think it was the fulcrum, as Jim suggests, the proxy for all kinds of issues. As you suggest, Brian, there were 5 murders a day, 6 murders a day. Jim might know better than I, but back then, a crime was very much an issue, but race was also very much an issue. Howard Beach, Bernard Goetz, the Crown Heights incident. So all of these cases very much in the news, very much about race. But yes, of course, class is always an underpinning.
And listeners who remembers 1989, our lines are open for anyone who remembers the original coverage of the Central Park jogger attack 30 years ago this week and what you thought then and what you learned from the subsequent revelations about who was really involved. Or anyone else may call 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 for our All Things Considered host and legal analyst Jamie Floyd and Jim Dwyer from The Times, who was a reporter for Newsday then. Jim, what did you want to say?
Just to pick up on what Jamie was saying about this lynching strain in our culture, it was not invisible even then. Patrick Buchanan, who was a prominent columnist and voice at the time, said a gallows ought to be erected in Central Park. The current president of the United States was then a real estate developer in New York. He took out full-page ads in the newspapers calling for the restoration of the death penalty, mm-hmm. and at a news conference said, "I want to hate. This is what we should be doing."
We have that clip. Hating. I'm going to play it. Donald Trump, he called for the death penalty, like you say, even though this wasn't a murder, and said he wanted them to suffer, and then this.
"You better believe that I hate the people that took this girl and raped her brutally. You better believe it. And it's more than anger, it's hatred. And I want society to hate them."
And we pulled that clip from the HBO documentary Breslin and Hamill to credit them. Jamie, this next question could be a whole segment by itself, but can you talk about the role of confessions in the original case? Now, she was unconscious and couldn't remember anything.
Right. And says she still does not.
Did not identify the defendants in court, from what I understand.
Right.
But they confessed. How important were the confessions to the public perception and to the legal process? And why were they later revealed to be flawed?
Oh, my goodness. There's so much there. I'll try and be as brief as I can. And then, Jim, you may want to jump in. Okay, first of all, the Innocence Movement and Project had not begun yet. The Innocence Project that's based here in New York and now has grown into a movement with projects all around the country and world was founded in 1992. So that's thereafter. And Yousef Salaam, who is one of the Central Park Five, is now on the board of the Innocence Project. So that's the first thing I want to say. Donald Trump, who you just played, continues to insist that these boys are guilty. Now men, when they were released. Okay, the confessions. I mentioned the Innocence Project, not just because of its tie to this case and they helped achieve these exonerations, but because their DNA exonerations and research have demonstrated that in cases where people have been wrongfully convicted and proved to be DNA has demonstrated that they were falsely convicted. In 25% of those cases, we have a wrongful confession. In other words, people are confessing to crimes they did not commit.
Which baffles the mind for most people.
If you're curious listeners, you can go to the Innocence Project website, and they have listed there the reasons for wrongful convictions. And one of those is false confession, eyewitness identification, bad forensics. There are all kinds of reasons, but wrongful confession is the one that people really find baffling. As you say, it is counterintuitive. Why would someone confess to a crime they did not commit? Well, they're young, they're stressed, they're kept overnight and away from their parent or guardian. The parents or guardians were there for a time, but kept on the other side of the door. Those parents and guardians are unsophisticated. They're afraid. They're told, well, your kid will be able to go home. Let's just talk to them for a little bit longer.
I read one quote. I don't know how accurately it's attributed to one of the parents who said, just tell them what they want to hear. Otherwise, you can't go home.
You'll be able to go home once
you do that.
And then I'll let Jim jump in. They don't feed them. They don't give them anything to drink. They're tired, so they start to wear down. And we find also that wrongful confessions come very often from young people, people with intellectual disabilities, people who are compromised in some way. So, and then finally, I will say that these confessions were inconsistent with one another, and were in language that 14 to 16 year old boys just don't use. And if you have any familiarity with the kind of language that a rapist would use, these confessions were also inconsistent with that. So everything about the case smelled, plus there was no physical evidence tying these boys to the scene. All they had were the confessions. Okay, I'm done.
Jim, what do you recall most vividly about your own writing or reporting on that or other aspects of the case at the time and that you have come to say maybe you misjudged as a journalist?
I recall being in court when the confession of Raymond Santana was first testified to by a detective. And I'm going to paraphrase, but this is approximately what was said. I then, acting with others, together we did proceed to grab the female victim and forcibly move her from the road and so forth. And it was all this textbook legal language. And at the time, it was striking to me that both the language in that confession, so-called confession, and that same day, if I'm not conflating my memory, it came out that there was no semen from the boys there. There was no blood from there. There was nothing physically linking them to the crime. And, you know, at the time I wrote that these are not words that ever sat on the lip of any 14-year-old boy. And, you know, I wish I had been more vigorous in my skepticism and public about it. One of the reporters, the columnist from Newsday at the time, who I think was almost, singular in her open skepticism, was a woman named Carol Agus. And she vigorously reported on the case and was saying, there's something wrong here. She was not shy about saying that. And I regret myself that I had not been more forceful in what I said about it.
Newsday was the organization that had the most skeptical and I would even say critical coverage. Jim, Cheryl McCarthy, I believe, was also a colleague of yours. Am I right about that? And
Cheryl was also a colleague. Yep.
Yeah, and they, yep, they were all asking important questions about what was going on here in New York City in that courthouse, especially as we approached the date of trial, which was in 1990.
When we continue in a minute, we'll take some of your phone calls with your own memories or observations since on the Central Park jogger attack and the subsequent injustices around it, the attack itself 30 years ago this Friday. And we're going to play a clip of the Manhattan DA who wrongly prosecuted these guys, Robert Morgenthau, on this show, looking back on it years later after they were exonerated. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, as we're acknowledging the 30th anniversary this Friday of the so-called Central Park jogger attack, the very dark day in the history of New York City, both for the brutal rape and beating of the victim in the northern part of Central Park, and then of the wrongful convictions of five Black and Latino teenagers for the attack, with WNYC legal analyst as well as All Things Considered host Jamie Floyd and Jim Dwyer from the New York Times, who was a reporter for Newsday covering the story at the time. Before we get to the Robert Morgenthau clip, Jamie, Matias Reyes,
yes,
confessed to the crime,
yes,
in prison to one of the Central Park,
yes,
five.
Yes, Corey Wise.
For people who didn't follow that part of the story briefly, how did that happen, and why would a guy who wasn't charged in the case do that?
Well, he was a serial rapist, as I think you pointed out earlier. He was also in prison for a murder. And he says he got religion. And he had been confessing for quite some time to a number of people, other inmates and officials, and no one was paying much attention. And eventually he got the ear of someone, including Corey Wise, who told his lawyers, and a prison official who also reported back to one of the detectives on the case. And eventually his DNA was a match to evidence from the crime scene, the underwear of the victim and some of her clothing.
And again, that was the only semen sample.
Indeed.
From the scene that police, from what I've read, wrongly assumed it came from a sixth member of the gang.
Well, they said.
Who they were never able to identify.
Well, going back to the point of trial, when they could not match the DNA of the five defendants to the crime scene or any of the rape kit evidence, they then supposed, using a generous term, there must have been a sixth perpetrator. Now, to be fair, there had been a lot of mischievous activity. I choose that word carefully, in the park.
These guys were doing things
A lot of kids were in the park that night, up to about 30 kids were running through the park that night. There had been other assaults in the park. A cyclist knocked off his cycle, a man robbed here and there throughout the park, all the way down to 59th Street, throughout the park. And so the police were, I think, confused and concerned about how to handle this case in the context of what the larger criminal activity was in the park that night. And these boys got swept up in it and then targeted for this crime. But when the DNA did not match, and Jim can speak to this, I think, better than I can, the Central Park division of the police department, you know, there's that precinct in Central Park, did not handle this case. It went to homicide because she was very near to death. And instead of attaching the case to the serial rapist they had on the east side, which the papers had been reporting on, which they knew they were looking for this guy, instead it was being treated mm-hmm. as a homicide case. And the two cases never linked up until 2002, when Matias Reyes confesses and his DNA is a hit. And he insists he did this alone.
Derek on the Upper West Side, you're on WNYC. Hi, Derek.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You were asking for people to call in who remember the case.
Thank you.
I remember it and the aftermath. Key points are it parallels to the Scottsboro Boys case in that from nothing to depression. Similar circumstances, but more importantly, matching in the exoneration issue. The semen was too old. The semen age was the key issue. Scottsboro Boys case, the semen age did not match the timeline of the crime. In the Central Park jogger case, the jogger they found semen, and when it didn't match the boys, by the way, there were originally eight, then they whittled it down to five mm-hmm. with the circular confessions, and in the trial. I believe it was the prosecution, and I only know from the comment of the mother of, I think it's Salim Mohammed, I think his name is.
Yusuf Salam.
Yeah. She made the comment with the defense attorney to news media in a conference outside the courthouse. Her exact words was, oh, she was a nasty woman. To have semen in her running down her leg that was 3 days old into her socks. And the bottom line is something about the sperm dies after so many hours after ejaculation. I can't remember if it's 18 or 28 hours, something like that. But the timeline of the semen and the sperm didn't match the boys. In addition to that, the boys had confessed to a couple of wilding incidents. I think the guy being pushed off the bike, and I think somebody had their Walkman taken. They admitted to committing crimes.
Other crimes.
The other section of the park, that is to say, they couldn't have done the rape because they weren't in that.
Right.
They could have got from one point to the other, and the cops had said.
Derek, I'm going to leave it there for time. Thank you very much. Jim Dwyer, do you want to reflect back on any of that? And Derek used the word wilding. which I think originated in the New York Post and became an emblematic and controversial word at the time. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think he made a couple of good points, but I think they help us to understand what changed in 2002 when the Mateus Reyes confession came forward and the DNA matched him. What that they always knew they had this unmatched DNA, but they having his narrative as an alternative to the very unsteady confessions that they had gotten from the kids in April of 1989, suddenly everything looked different. And we were living in an age when we could understand how confessions could be extracted from people under the right circumstances. So it wasn't alone the DNA that exonerated the young men. It was the DNA plus 30 years of wisdom about how we make mistakes in criminal justice.
And the Manhattan DA who prosecuted the Central Park Five was Robert Morgenthau. He was on this show in 2010, and I asked him about his regrets over the case.
This was not a happy day, but this prisoner up there on the Canadian border said, "I did it, and I did it alone." We first thought the guy just wants a free trip to New York, but we had his DNA taken, and it confirmed that he was the person who did it. Then we proceeded to a lot of interviews to make sure that we hadn't missed anything. But then, I mean, the statute says, and I kept telling people, read the statute. The statute said, if there's newly discovered evidence, which, if available at the time of the trial, would probably have resulted in a verdict more favorable to the defendants. And how could you say, you got a guy who says, I did it, and confirmed by DNA. So we could not, under the law, we can't move to vacate a sentence. But I told the defense counsel and I told the judge that we would consent to a motion to vacate that sentence, and we did.
Robert Morgenthau, the Manhattan DA, at the time of the Central Park Five case on this show, expressing regrets in 2010. Jamie, we just have 30 seconds left. I'll give you the last word. I want to mention that on All Things Considered on Friday, which is the actual 30th anniversary day of the attack, you're going to continue to look back on what we've learned and perhaps what we failed to learn in 30 years. So I just want everybody to know that'll be happening on All Things Considered with Jamie on Friday. But a last word as you listen to Robert Morgenthau there.
Well, I guess the reason we're going to continue the conversation, Brian, is because while I do think there have been improvements in the system, there have been, excellent books like Jim's Actual Innocence that he wrote with Peter Neufeld and Barry Schack, and we've started to learn about the truth of wrongful conviction. We still have so much more work to do in our criminal justice system to get it right.
WNYC, All Things Considered host and legal analyst Jamie Floyd and Jim Dwyer, now with The Times, then with Newsday, and also author of the iBook from 2014, False Conviction, Innocence, Guilt, and Science. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.